Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Business Beyond Performance podcast. My name is Matt Powell, here with my fantastic co-host, Joe Staub.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate that.
Hey, anytime. So I'm super excited for the episode today. The biggest reason is the gentleman we have on today, Andy Reese or Andy Rise, depending upon how you want to say it, and I'm sure you'll hear both today during the episode, is on here. And he was a 22-year Army vet. He worked in the special operations community doing multiple things, specifically helping with radio comms, all that good stuff, and communicating with the birds above. And then he also went on to work at Texas A&M University, and as well as working with the Cincinnati Reds, where he's actually a full-time staff member now as a mental / cognitive performance specialist. So somebody I'm super excited to talk to.
No, and just an awesome guy. I mean, I met him through you. I was fortunate enough to meet him in person when I was working with Strive. We had traveled down to visit you, and you connected us with him because he was still in his role at the time there. And me and Nicola, the CEO of Strive, were able to sit and have lunch with him. And I just hit it off with him. He's a nice guy. Again, just everything that like all our guests are. He's humble. He's open. He's willing to learn. He's willing to, you know, he knows what he knows and he knows what he doesn't know. And we had a great conversation over lunch. And, you know, that was about a year and a half ago. Actually, no, hell, that was 2 years ago now. That's, you know, COVID's making my mind slip. So it was almost 2 years ago. So, and in those 2 years, just text messages here and there, suggestions here and there. Big shout out. I gave him the suggestion on Rocketbook. He got one, hit me back, said it was his favorite thing. So big one there. So nothing but great things to say about Andy.
Another cool thing about him is he has such a different style as a performance and a cognitive performance coach who wants to do something for his guys, right? Especially in the baseball realm compared to working with tactical athletes previously. He has such a different approach to some of our other guests, like Dr. Megan Sullivan, who we had on previous. So it's really cool to see the dynamic differences as far as what they do as far as with their athletes and with their subject matter expert, you know, consulting roles they have, but also to hear how they interact differently with their families because of their background and how they interact differently with those around them who aren't even the athletes or someone they're coaching. So he's just one of those guys you can learn a lot from. He has so many cool experiences, as we talked about. And I am just super excited to see how much people can take away from this. One of our biggest goals every week, you know, and you could go back to listen to episode zero, is that we want to give back. And I think something that Andy Reese does really, really well is to give back and mentor and teach whenever able.
No, well said.
Perfect. Without any further delay, let's go into episode six with Andy Reese. Hey, welcome back, everybody. We're here with Andy Reese. I mean, when we started putting together a list of names and people we want to talk to, you were at the top, dude. Somebody who has worked, I miscounted earlier when I was going through writing the email to you, four jobs at the same time. You're working with the Rockies, Texas A&M University, the United States Army, something, and then you're also doing consulting work on the side. So, 20-year vet, somebody who just recently got out. I met you at the tail end of your Army career as you were transitioning out, or still are transitioning out, however you want to put that.
Yeah.
Man, thank you for coming on the show. We appreciate it.
Thanks, fellas. I mean, you guys both know how highly I think of you personally and professionally. And, you know, thank you for giving me a reason to not plug into the madness that's going on tonight on election night. And so, you know, I'm glad that we're recording this so that people can go, you know, whether you're happy or mad or anywhere in between, you could, you know, maybe get something out of this conversation that's going to add value and make you better. So thanks, fellas.
Absolutely, man. Can you go through a little more of that, what you do right now for each one of those different different people or different groups of people?
Yeah, for sure. It's how much time we got? Yeah, you know, you guys know you got to do like the hook or something like that, or give me the cutoff like my wife does. Yeah. All right, so I'll just kind of start where I'm at now. Like Matt said, I'm you know, 20 plus year Army officer, and which, you know, is a story in of itself. But what I'm doing now is that I'm working for Texas A&M. So I guess the central theme is really about coaching. It's the art and science of coaching, who I am as a coach, just like you guys, Joe and Matt, and I love being a coach of coaches. And I think of coaching from the macro perspective and how it applies to training people to perform at their best, and whether it's in, you know, from the battlefield to the boardroom to the ball field, you know. And so to me, those are the three arenas that I like to play in right now. And to me, like, you know, the positions that I've been in, you don't think of an Army leader as kind of being someone who's a coach, but you know, when it makes a lot of sense, and people like you are in athletics, you guys really get that. And especially you guys have worked with both of those populations, but when it comes to coaching, I work at Texas A&M. We have a coaching academy, been around for a few years, and we train, educate, and help equip and resource not only prospective coaches who are at the undergrad or graduate level, but we also help coaches in practice from the middle school to the professional level. And we do that on campus. We do that, on site to different schools, and we do that online. And I'm also directing our veterans coaching program, which is a really cool program, because I just think veterans are a great resource to be able to help fill the shortage of coaches that we have in our country right now. Like, I know here in Texas, you know, we lose about, 10,000 coaches a year change jobs for various reasons. About 6,000 of those coaches don't come back. So we have this huge shortage. I mean, you guys know how big a difference in the development of young people, they make. Strength coaches, you guys know this full well, spend the most time out of any person compared to outside of their parents or even outside of the teacher's realm. And in terms of development of young people, we feel like veterans, because of their background, their knowledge, skills, and experience can help fill that gap and then, and create pathways to go do that is one of the things that we're working to do right now. So I'm really enjoying that. It's kind of my passion project, which I know we're going to talk about why you do things. So I'm doing that. And then I'm a mental skills coach for the Colorado Rockies. So that's, I've done a little bit. I've dabbled over the last 10 years in the consulting world and coaching space. My background is in sport and performance psychology. And of course, there is no pathway for that in the United States Army. So the last 10 years, I've had to do that working with elite tactical athletes, whether it's Rangers guys like with you, Matt, or Special Forces folks. And then, so that's been an odyssey. And then also to consulting on the side. And so I've worked with like the Mariners and worked some NFL teams. And so this was a natural fit for me to come in. Although COVID, this thing called COVID happened, right? It's spring training, kind of put a Debbie Downer on the whole season. But that itself created a lot of opportunities to be able to do remote work that I don't think baseball ever experienced before, but they were forced to put in this position where coaches who've been in baseball their entire lives and have never turned on Zoom before, and so our team was able to kind of come in and help, teach them how to do that. And so that's been a really cool odyssey, although I'd rather have kind of be in, be around the smell and feel of baseball versus a Zoom call. That's, being around the sport and learning about that has been a lot of fun. And then the next thing is just consulting, and that's where kind of the leadership side of things comes in. And so I call coaching is really the intersection between my expertise and passion for leadership and, performance psychology. And that really comes down into coaches. And so you think about executive coaching, that's I'm doing that as well too. And then also traditional management consulting, where you're working with a client to help them become not only become more effective and efficient, but also how do they run their teams, to get the most out of themselves and help better support their clients towards the improving their bottom line. And so that in itself has been a really interesting challenge too with COVID, because you tend to think that that's the first thing to go. But it's been interesting to see how people really hold on to that, especially those high human skills when you're in a time of crisis. So those are really the three things that I'm doing right now. I retire 1st of February, so that's going to be a great day. I'm looking forward to that. And just excited about life 2.0 and to be able to do more of what I want, which includes collaborating with guys like you.
Man, that was awesome. We definitely appreciate it. One of the things that I definitely want to do with this, podcast show, whatever, is I want to talk about the mental performance side, because so many of the people who are going to listen to this are going to be strength coaches, athletic trainers, physical therapists, personal trainers, massage therapists, whoever, other people in the fitness world who don't have a whole lot of access to people like you.
Sure.
So my next question is, can you break down kind of your basic ideology and how you kind of use that for your different pieces of your business?
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, the bottom line is that I think that, if all things are equal when it comes to, training training your body, training your team, and your craft. I mean, the one thing that, those things are very tangible, right? And we can immediately see the return on the investment and see that, right? And that's what's been so awesome in your guys' field of strength and conditioning, even with you, Matt, and the other hat you wear as a dietitian, the sports science world, that we tend to, the things that we gravitate towards, is the Peter Drucker principle of what gets measured gets managed, right? But it's very difficult to manage, you know, the arguably the most important 6 inches on the battlefield, the boardroom, and the ball field is between your ears. And so to me, I realized that in early in my career when I was playing football at West Point. And that's when I started understanding the art and sciences and understanding that training your brain is as important as training your body, your team, and your craft, right? I mean, so that's really the bottom line. So how do you, you know, so instead of leaving that to chance or as this byproduct of working harder and, you know, being really technically sound and all the specialization you see in sports or in, frankly, in business and in life, how do you, what is the process to be able to get after that? And mental skills training to me was really the answer to that. And I think the last 100 years, and especially the last 50 years, we learned more about the brain than we ever have before in humankind. So it's really given the efficacy, to use my 75-cent word for the day. You know, it's given the teeth and the tail behind what we do, right? Whereas before it was kind of done between the shadows and no one talked about, Beast Mode would say, Marshawn Lynch, your mentals, right? No one talked about your mentals, right? They talk about your chickens, but not your mentals, right? But because that was something we talked about behind its closed doors in the shadows, and God forbid you go to a psychologist because that meant you were broken or something was wrong with you. And now it's, you know, because of the, it's become so popular with elite tactical athletes at the Olympic professional level. Now you see the trickle down all the way down. But again, the problem is, who is the subject matter expert that I have to rely on, you know? And that's where I suppose people like me come into play.
Nice. Andy, so me and Matt, and I give credit to Matt because it's his thing and I'm helping. We've picked people who, when they speak and they say 10 seconds, 20 seconds worth of stuff, there's so much in that 20 seconds. So as always, shout out to Rocket Book. I'm taking the notes. Yeah, you know, hey, they're a Boston-based company. I'm from Boston. You got to give credit.
It's a potential sponsor. I like it.
Exactly. Hey, man, I fell in love with the product. I recommend it to everybody. So I get my first notes, right? There's one thing of talking about bringing people in like you. I actually have a call with Court Whitman on Thursday, who we've been talking back and forth. So I talked with him from connecting to you when I first met you, when I came down, when I was working for Stroud. Yeah. Then me and him got connected,
yeah.
Had a great conversation, had another great conversation. I was supposed to go on his podcast. And then that COVID thing, I know you mentioned whatever that thing was happening.
Yeah. Right.
So circling back around with him, we're bringing him on. I have a call with him to kind of get him up to speed on what we're doing.
Yeah.
So great tie in there with another guy in your world.
Yeah, for sure.
There's two big things I hit on, right? It's, you said, you know, from what you're doing, shifting the focus to online. So I look at that as being able to adapt on the fly. Yeah. And you mentioned training your brain. So yeah. The first question, I got two questions for you. The first one is, how do you train your brain, right? There's being able to adapt is easy, right? Everyone gets, oh, you train. Yeah. Change a different exercise or, you know, deadlift to get your back strong. Like, that's easy from a physical toolkit, right? But training your brain to be cognitively capable to adapt quickly on the fly,
yep.
Given your shift in focus to online stuff. So let's get into that. And then the second one, which yep. which I think you can maybe hit on first, you know, it's the way my notes are written. It's the second question, was you referenced mental training as a tool versus because you have a problem, and the stigma of for so long, it was because you had a problem. And I want to get your interest or gauge on why it's called mental training now. It's no longer called sports psych. It's no longer connotated in that you have a problem, you need to see the psychologist.
Yeah.
It's get your mental.
Yeah, so that's right. Yeah.
Hit me. I know that's a big question. I usually ramble my questions because I am who I am, but hit me. Mental training as a tool versus an issue, and then also going into training your brain to adapt.
Yeah, I think it's right. I think the first thing is to kind of understand like what is training, right? And this is easy for you guys. I mean, it's really about the process of bringing skill in so you can then let skill out, right? And I think training allows you to be able to technically do, you know, over time allows you to, if you or you work through this skill development process, right? And so you start off, you're unconsciously incompetent, right? It means I don't know what I don't know, right? And through the work of, you know, education and or training, that it really, that's where coaches come in, because they help do both, but really it's the application towards performance that comes in. So over time, you know, if I bring skill in using, you know, good quality training with the help of a subject matter expert coach, over time, I can become unconsciously competent, right? Which means I can do it at a high level without thinking. And so I think whether it's a physical skill or a mental skill, the process of skill development is fundamentally the same, right? And I think the science proves that, right? And so what we're taking is the same principles of periodization that you use on the physical side of things, you know, same work and recovery, all those fundamental principles, the reason why we're both housed in like health and kinesiology, right? Because they're sisters of the same thing, because we're talking about the mind and the body, right? And, you know, within the human being, right? So I think, you know, the understanding the process is super important. And that's where mental skills comes in, right? You know, so mental skills is really the menu of things that you can do, you know, just like Olympic level, you know, if I was to talk to you about like, hey, what are the top five lifts, you guys would be able to tell me what those are, right? Depending on what the athletic, you know, performance context is. But from sports psychology, that's basically about the same, right? So for us, you know, the principle, so we're talking about goal pursuit. That's a big one, right? You know, which is a process. We're talking about self-talk. We're talking about visualization or using imagery. Those are big ones as well, too. We're talking about understanding motivation and how that works. And we're also talking about attention control, which in the business is called arousal control. But we don't call it that for obvious reasons, right? Because every time you say arousal, you get a snicker, whether or not it's Rangers or, you know, the Texas Rangers, right? So those are kind of the fundamentals. But I think so understanding what those are, being able to, you know, teach those skills for what they are, how they work, and then how to put them into application. And I think that's the important part too, is that they need to be applied. In my field of sport and performance psychology, sport is a context, performance in a micro sense, performance is a macro sense. And that's what I love about these skills, is they're transferable. So that's why you guys teach movement. You know, and so because it's not about the lifts and the weight, it's about the movement patterns, right? So for us, it's about how you think, how you, your awareness of your thoughts, how you control your thoughts. And then beyond self is how do you understand your operating environment, how that influences you, and then how you influence it, right? And so I think that when you look at that, the transferability of the skills is super, super important. So performance, meaning executing tasks, at the upper range of your potential consistently over time, regardless of circumstances, right? That's the textbook definition of mental toughness, which is what I like, because coaches in athletics, like, always when you say mental toughness, like, oh yeah, I know what you're talking about. But what I love about it is you're not, you know, in my world, you're not beholden to a gym. You're not beholden to a period of time. You can get reps and sets of using and applying mental skills, you know, 24/7, literally, even when you sleep. You know, you're technically getting that recovery piece in, right? And so I think the sport piece, the transferability through performance, the bringing skill in and letting skill out, understanding the menu, getting quality repetition with the help of expertise while you're seeking self-knowledge. And I think it's also important for people to understand is that just like working out in the gym, you know, really strength and development in terms of your brain through the process of, and it's proven through things like neuroplasticity, you know, the fact that our brain actually changes structure over the course of our lifetime, that doesn't happen once, like, while we're in the gym, right? That happens in what you do in between your time in the gym, right? And so I think there's so many parallels in our worlds. And I think when I can put it in athletes and coaches context and something that they can, that is easy for them to understand because it's tangible, like in your world, and then I can relate it in the same principles and concepts from a cognitive and emotional side, cognitive being how you think, emotions how you feel, and then how that translates to your behaviors, what you do and don't do. When I can put all those things together in the sense of your world, that the lights really start to come on. And that's why I think the multidisciplinary approach of practitioners like us working together is really where it's at.
You summed up a lot of things there, Andy, and that was awesome. So being able to take that and apply it to different pieces is such a big part for all of us, right? Having analogies and being able to actually implement it into their different parts of their life. Because so many athletes don't give a crap about the weight room. And that's fine with me. As long as they go out in the field and they perform their best, or they go out to, you know, the mission and perform their best, I really don't give a shit if they like the weight room or not. As long as they're getting better at what they need to do.
That's right.
So one of the things that I thought about as you were talking is, you talked about how it's a perishable skill. You talked about neuroplasticity, all these amazing big time words. So breaking that down a little easier for some of our people who are listening, what are some skills and drills and other information you recommend to take that, not only for their coaching profession, like what they do, you know, 06 to, you know, 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, but also what they're doing after that for their entrepreneurship. So from an entrepreneur standpoint, what are some skills and drills you would recommend from your side of the house?
Yeah, and I'll make this really simple, because I think that anything that you get from pop psychology or self-study, you're not going to have a certified sports psychologist if you're, you know, on your own and you're bootstrapping and you're trying to start a business, or maybe, you know, you're a junior coach somewhere, you know, you're even a student, right? And so there's really 4 buckets when it comes to mental skills, right? One is, I call them competencies, right? So these are self-awareness. The other is self-regulation. That's within self. Beyond that, you know, is your understanding your operating environment. And the third one is influence, right? And so two are within self. The last two are beyond self, right? You know, because ultimately, you know, the process of what I call mastery, which is the process of continual improvement, is really what the philosophy is all about, kind of going back to what we talked about, right? So if we're competing to get better and become the best version of ourselves, we're using this process of mastery, right? So I would say everything begins and ends with self-awareness. So if you walk away with nothing else, it's understanding, you know, the connection between how you think and how that affects your behavior, right? As far as what's working for you and what's not. And I think a lot of times we just go about our day just doing things, and we're not aware that, you know, hey, we have 30 to 50,000 independent thoughts going on in our day, and 80% of those are negative, right? So I think good at being aware of how you're thinking, what you're thinking about, and then taking some time, you know, even like in a journal, whether it's, you know, the Rocket book, or it's just a good old fashioned, you know, freaking Moleskine. I mean, you know, or a napkin somewhere, right? The idea is to become self-aware of what's working and what's not in terms of how I think, how that affects my emotions, how that affects my physiology, like what's going on inside my body, and how that ultimately affects what I do and I don't do. If you can start and actually deliberately start to think about that, you know, and understanding how those things are interrelated with each other and what's working and what's not, I mean, that's 50% of it right there. That's kind of like showing up to the gym, right? Now, once you show up, you got to start putting quality work in, right? You know, but to me, if you're not self-aware, you're not showing up. And so to me, that's always where I start. And it's where, and honestly, if it's CEOs, Major League Baseball players, badass door kickers, you know, like the, you work with Matt, you know, special forces guys, whatever it is. I mean, anybody who lacks self-awareness is really behind the power curve. But people are self-aware are more likely then to be able to bring all sorts of skills in, including mental, emotional skills. They're going to make them better at what they do. Is that helpful? Like, we can get more specific if you want to. Yeah.
Well, so this is my question to you then, Andy, right? When you factor in all your personal and professional pulls, right? So one of the things, you're a father, you have 4 kids. I have 2. Matt's got 1, right? Our kids are much younger than yours. So
your kids are probably a lot stronger than mine, by the way. I'm just throwing that out there.
My little guy, who's not even 2, can jump on 2 feet and do a pull-up. Just saying, maybe we trained it, maybe we didn't, I don't know. We had a lot of time in COVID, what can I say?
He eats a lot of protein shakes.
He does. So, personal pulls, right? Professional pulls. Now, Matt already discussed, you have multiple jobs. You were in the Army, right? You had all of these things coming at you. So dig into it. How did you find self-awareness? When did you recognize self-awareness was a key? When did you become self-aware, like Skynet per se? And then when did you start acting, moving forward with that ability?
Yeah, no, it's a really good, great question, Joe. You know, I think it really, when I became really self-aware is through failure, right? And I think that's, we have a few, human beings, we tend to have a tendency to move away from the things that get us uncomfortable and that, but those are really the areas where we learn and grow the most. And I think I've always been a really self-aware person, like my pretty high emotional intelligence, right? And that's almost, there's a shadow side of that, right? You know, because I've also was really self-conscious, right? And very, like, very sensitive kid, right? And so knowing that, I think, you know, I told you guys early on, you know, I'm forging this career path. My first 10 years were pretty unconventional. My last 10 years were just freaking crazy, right? You know, because, you know, at the 10-year mark, I found this field. I figured out that I was going to get out of the military. I just come off a long deployment, went back to teach at West Point, and just absolutely fell in love with this field of sports psychology, the potential within the military, and understanding the potential outside of it, and then needing to explore that, right? Because, so in order to stay relevant in the field, like, you know, I had to go do things outside of the military, and that was really frowned upon. That was like crazy, like how dare you, you know, while you're on leave, go working with a professional football team. Like, it was like a taboo, you know, and it wasn't because like I felt like I was cool or anybody else. I had this opportunity, I had this vehicle to go do it, but I was curious. Like, I'm a curious person, right? And so, you know, the old adage that curiosity can kill the cat. And I think when I got overextended, as more variables were picking up in my life, right? And then, you know, as you go up in rank, you get more responsibility. And then there's this magic years called being a major, which really freaking suck, you know? And then nobody ever wants to be a major. It's like the George Costanza of the U.S. Army. Nobody really likes them. Like, you know, they just tolerate them. So here I am, this George Costanza of the Seinfeld Army. And I just was like, I was just miserable, and I was grinding it out. But yet I had these opportunities to go do other things. And so, like, I started to do these other things. Like, I was helping out with a nonprofit, the Green Beret Foundation. They were asking for help. My buddy was the sports psych for the Seattle Mariners. So I would go up for every homestand and got a chance to work with 4 future Hall of Famers while I'm in uniform. It's kind of like, you know, I mean, who the hell gets a chance to do that? And I was lucky that it was weird because I had to, like, kind of keep this secret. Like, it was like this taboo thing. But here was the problem, that I was already at max capacity when this job that I'm in. There was weeks where, you know, I'm not seeing my family except on the weekends, and I'm exhausted. Oh, by the way, I'm getting my master's degree online while I'm doing all this. I mean, I was completely pegged out on red, you know, just like an idiot. I look back at myself, I just want to smack myself around, you know. I'm like, what are you thinking, dude? Meanwhile, my wife's like drowning. She's in Washington and 1,800 square feet with 4 young kids, doesn't know anybody, and it's not, you know, sorry, Washington, you're not exactly the friendliest people. She's not exactly making friends, right? So, I mean, you know, I was just a complete idiot, and I was failing. My wife just one day was like, what the hell are you doing? I mean, and she really is the yin and yang, and I give her all the credit in the world for this. And then, because I just would have continued to do this, and I would have burned out, something would have given, you know, who knows. But you know, what I kind of realize is that I'm a pleaser by nature too. So I'm self-aware of that. I hate saying no. And so I had to come up with this idea that if it's not hell yes, then it's no. And how to say no in a way that, didn't burn bridges, it continued to treat people the way they wanted to be treated. Not the golden rule, the platinum rule, treating people the way they wanted to be treated, not the way that I wanted to be treated. And that's when, you know, just taking some stuff off my plate. And so, and it's like, you know, I'm not Superman, right? Because, you know, the human brain isn't designed, you're designed to be able to do one thing at a time, right? And so I don't have this ability to be this super multitasker, because that's a myth. What I did is I had this ability to really screw things up bad enough and have someone in my life that allowed me to screw it up and still love me, and bosses that didn't fire me, and other people allowed me to continue to do other things, and then have this hard lesson. To when I was like, you know, then I started to really slim things down and really narrow my focus. But then I reflect back, and I will tell you that, you know, I am really glad that I still, people ask me, well, do you regret that you were doing all these other things? And I said, no, because those other things gave me purpose and motivation that kept me going in my day job. And inevitably I learned something by working with the Mariners or the Green Beret Foundation that I could bring back into my practice. that helped me make me and my team better at what they did. And so the fact that I was unconventional, I'm not unapologetic for it, because it made me better. It made my teams better, just the way I went about it. The process I went about it was just really shitty, right? And so, you know, so what I did is to iterate and learn, is that when I got the next opportunity, and then I'm assessing all these opportunities that are out there, how do I make all those lines intersect really tightly to where they feed off each other deliberately, intentionally, so it doesn't feel like I'm doing five things. I'm really just doing one thing. It's one tree. They're just five branches that come out of it. Does that make sense?
No, it makes a lot of sense. So again, there's so much to unpack in this friggin' minute and a half talking. So a couple things, right? And again, always have my notes, right? I think one of the reasons, Andy, me and you, even though we met in person for, you know, an hour over chow hall food at Benning, my keys to success and my leadership philosophy, you're echoing, and again, I know they're Matt's as well, things, how you treat people, paying attention, you know, like, there's just so many, I call them obvious to a sense, but people overlook them as keys to success. Sure. So you reference failure, and on previous podcasts, and even today, talking to one of the guys who I work with, you know, we were talking about election stuff and other stuff, and I was like, I'm a flawed human being. I fail every day. Yeah. I recognize that, and I embrace it, because me failing or being bad or not hitting the level I need to is an opportunity for me to recognize I need to improve. So right. In your world, in mental skills training, sports psychology, you know, self-efficacy development.
Yeah.
The word confidence can be polarizing depending on which side of the coin and who you believe and what you read. Yeah. I learned it as micro confidence development. You know, you find the good, right? If the best thing you did today is tie your shoes, recognize you tied your shoes. You know, Admiral McRaven talks about make your bed, start your day off with a win, that kind of stuff. So what's your take on confidence as a word related to mental skill development? What's your take on micro confidence, or the other way I've heard it said is, you know, the small victories, or another one is, you know, building the small steps, or all the things that mean the same thing, but the word semantically gets jumbled into the picture.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe we could do something real quick, and I'm not trying to like pull like some like ninja move on you, like, but like, let's maybe think about that in the context of getting faster. Right. So like when you work with your athletes, they come to you and like, hey, I want to be fast, man. Like, let's say they're getting ready for the NFL combine or whatever, right? Like, and I know you've been through this. Like, so is like fast an outcome or an attribute, or is that, you know, where do you see the idea? When they come to you, I want to be fast. How do you respond to that?
So the first question I usually, what do you mean fast?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. So great question. So like, now let's put it back in the context to me. So you come to me and say, hey, Andy, I want to be confident, right? And then that's what I say, like say it back to them, like, what do you mean? What do you mean by confident? Well, you know, and then they kind of use their own words. Right. And words like really mean things in our world. Right. And so I think that, you know, to make the point, right, it's being fast is like, you know, is an attribute, you know, in this case, being confident is an attribute, right. By me teaching you mental skills that you can then apply, you know, in a performance context, you know, does that mean that you're going to become more confident? That would be causational, right? You know, I mean, that. So I can't make those guarantees in my world, right? I mean, that may be a little bit more causational in your world. If you do X, Y, and Z, you will be faster, you know, but in my world, it's, you know, those dots that connect, you know, those behaviors and the outcome, they're fuzzier, right? Does that make sense? So I think that, you know, so there's a difference between using the other, you know, let's go back to the 75% word again, put it in the bucket. Self-efficacy is the inner belief in yourself, right? And so I think that is the really important thing, that in terms of a skill, belief in yourself, which is really training yourself to trust yourself, is really the key thing that I want to teach athletes, right? So no matter what happens, good, bad, or indifferent, maintaining that fundamental belief in themselves is really important. Now, there's task confidence is a little bit different, right? You know, so am I going to be, you know, am I going to go do something that has, let's use it in a military context. Like the first time that I went to combat and I got shot at, no matter how well I trained, how many thousands of hours I spent on the range or in a shoot house or whatever, there's no way in hell in 2003 I was going to be confident, you know, in combat the first time I got shot at. I just was not, it wasn't going to happen. But that isn't a prerequisite to still perform at an optimal level, right? Optimal meaning getting the most out of what you got, right? And I think that's the thing that we talk about is that in our roles, it's like we get really confused about the product and the outcome or the attribute, and we're not focused on the process and what goes into that and understanding that you can perform at an optimal level, meaning like you may, we all have shitty days, right? We all have days when you don't fucking want to go to the gym. We show up anyways. We got 50%. We're on 50% strength, right? But how do you still get 45% of that 50, right? And then it's the same world. In my world, that's the same thing cognitively, right? You know, so I think, hey, if you have to develop your perception of yourself, what you say to yourself, what you believe in yourself, no matter what happens, and then how do you talk to yourself, that narrative that happens, that explanatory style, that is super, super important. And that will increase the likelihood that when things that are good happen, you get to, that they're all the time, everything. When things are bad happen, it's one time, one thing, right? And we know with that, by practicing these mental skills, it'll be able to decrease the negative effects of bad things that happen in adversity. Like, so I get blown up by an IED on a patrol. Is that, you know, is that a one time, one thing or all the time, everything, right? Let's say it kills my buddy. I'm fucking pissed. Right. You know, these, you know, terrorists just killed my buddy. Right. Am I going to not go out the gate the next day, or am I going to be able to then turn this incredible tragedy into something that fuels me and my team to go take the fight to the enemy again? Now, that's,
Andy, let me jump in for two quick points. And again, I'll throw a word out and it means a lot of things. Compartmentalize.
Yeah.
In terms of being able to compartmentalize the experience versus the emotion and then drive action forward.
Yeah.
My point to you though is in everything we're talking about, personally, I have a reference to the four types of days you can have. You know, good days where you're ready to go, bad days where you're going to suck it up and find it, that kind of thing. And I think you hit on that well. The point I wanted to hammer home, I think fundamentally, and the way I explained it from a strength and conditioning standpoint is we used the physical act of development as a mechanism to build confidence within the person to drive them to success. And that was task success, sports success, you know, performance success. But the key thing, and again, part of I learned this from Matt and the other great mentors I had, was that bleeds out, right? So the bigger statement I have is, you know, you said it's a fuzzy thing in your world. Whereas in our world, you know, you came in day one, you lifted 100 pounds, you left day 10, you lifted 200 pounds. It's black and white. You couldn't, and now you can. Whereas that's in right. Your world, the efficacy and the cognitive skill set or tool set doesn't always connect to those things as an output. So one of the ways I framed it recently to people is, you know, we're trying to get you to do what you've never done with the blank, like you're already the world champion. And the blank in that statement, so do what you've never done with the skills, the tools, the confidence, the strength, the speed, the whatever, like you're already the world champion, because inherently you have to believe you can.
That's right.
And how do you, and this is a not only a question, but also the next thing I want to get into with you is, how do you do that across all the different things you do? Right. You use the major example. You're that guy, right? You're there. But how are you doing that as a dad? How are you doing that as trying to run a business, getting consultants? How are you doing that as a guy working with, you know, in the academic domain at Texas A&M? How are you doing something you've never done blank, like you're the world champion already?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Is I think that it's one of the things that's almost kind of glossed over in the behavioral science world, especially like in like applied sports psychology, for example, is the impact. And but it's starting to, the science is starting to catch up on this because it's related to beliefs, right? So core beliefs are your values, right? And I think there was like one of the seminal researchers and authors on this is a guy named Chris Peterson at the University of Michigan. And they came up with the VIA, the Values in Action Survey, and they look at your character strengths, and character being the connection between what you believe and what your behaviors are. And I think again, going back to that bedrock, you know, if we're as human beings, we're icebergs. We're at 10% is above the surface is 10% of what people see, which are behaviors. Below the surface are things like your attitudes and your emotions and all these things. I draw that out as a pyramid, I mean, the base of it is your values, right? Because that drives, you know, your engine of who you are as a human being throughout the course of your lifetime, right? And I think, you know, when I work with any performer in any of those contexts, that's the first thing that we go to. And they're like, why the hell are we doing this? I really want to get into the skills, right? It's just like when you deal with young athletes, you know, let's go hit this, you know, like you talk about movement. Just think Matt did it with my boys when I came in. They like, hey, when are we going to freaking hit the weights? He's like, no, let's talk about basic movement first, you know, which is brilliant, right? And it's fun to watch, you know? And so to me, the movement is understanding who you are. And the core of who you are is your values, right? So for me, as an example, going through that exercise and evolving that is, you know, my three core values are love, you know, which, you know, everybody who talks to me says you're a passionate guy, right? And they're the shadow side. Like, you know, I exude a lot of passion, right? You know, meaning kind of energy, my capacity to do work and engage with people and do the things that I want to do. And then the other one is service, right? That's kind of who I am. That's why I joined the Army. You know, helping others become better at what they do is at the core of who I am. And the third one is compete, you know, and that's the process, continual process of improvement to make myself better first. And that's not selfish, right? If I can't take care of myself, I sure as hell can't take care of anybody else, right? So if I want to help make other people become world-class performers in whatever the application is, you know, business, sports, military, otherwise, then I have to practice those principles, right? And so love, service, and competition are at the core of who I am, right? And that's really goes back to who do I align with and what do I do? Well, it goes back to those three values, right? I mean, I'm hanging out with you guys tonight, you know, because you guys align with my values, right? And my purpose in life. And I think that's what's really what matters. And I think before we go talk about what we're going to do and where we're going to go, we got to think about who we are as human beings. And from my standpoint, that starts with core beliefs or your values.
Love it, Andy. I always talk about aligning your actions with your values, because if you don't, you're in for catastrophe.
Yeah, for sure. You know, and I think it's really important organizationally too, that this is from the leader with leadership standpoint. We don't have to geek out as too much too, but the research shows that, you know, that organizations that have whose team values align with individual values, and that's where that alignment comes in, are just more successful. They make more money. They have happier employees, you know, better served, you know, customers and the work and it goes on and on and on.
I think you unpacked a whole lot right there, man. You did a great job of breaking down values based actions and why you do the things the way you do. So I guess that kind of leads into my question. I'm going to go two different ways with this, so I apologize. First one I want to talk about, you already kind of touched on it briefly, was failure and how as you build those mental reps and as you get into that situation, you know, you've never seen, you know, a live firefight before and there was no way to completely prepare for that. But like you said, those reps in the shoot house, those reps at the range, those reps breaching, et cetera, all kind of prepared you for that general idea of where you were in that situation.
Right.
What are some other ways to kind of be prepared for failure? Because I think it's one of those things that, you know, as a strength coach, you know, mental cognition coach, registered dietitian, et cetera, when they go into that side hustle, right, they start to become either, you know, doing stuff on the side with friends, family, other people, all of a sudden they're not the subject matter expert, or they are, but they're not reaching the people they want to, and they have to deal with things they've never dealt with before. So how do they get ready for that state of failure, and how do they prepare themselves for that?
Yeah, I think, you know, and I'm not going to, I'll take one angle. I'm kind of take my Army leader hat on for a minute here too, because I think that I mean, that's got to be deliberately a part of your plan, right? You know, like in the military, everybody talks about contingency planning, right? And so me, like, you know, it's like, and I'm doing it right now. This is, you know, I have a PACE plan, right? And so to me, I was a, you know, joint terminal attack controller. And it, you know what that is, you know, Matt, and, you know, that's the guy who jumps out airplanes and helps, you know, Green Berets and Rangers put warheads on foreheads, right? And so from a communication standpoint, I always had to have a PACE plan that's primary, alternate, contingency, and emergency. So that PACE plan, you know, is what I build into just about everything that I do, right? You know, and that at the very minimum, I have a primary and alternate, right? So I got to have a backup plan, right? Because, you know, I understand that mistakes are going to happen. Mistakes are kind of small, the small things that are kind of, you know, isolated and aren't compound, don't have compounding effects, right? Failures are kind of massive, right? So I know we kind of categorize failures the whole thing, but there's a different, you know, arc when it comes to mistakes versus like catastrophic failures, right? I mean, I don't really plan for catastrophic failures, right? But I do plan for mistakes. I do plan, you know, on compounding mistakes. I do plan on things that are beyond my control that are happening. And then I fall back onto my plan from a business side, knowing that that's going to happen, right? And so no one could have, and COVID is a great example right now. Nobody could have anticipated that, you know, a global pandemic was going to happen, let alone last this long. So like the two, but it's really interesting in the consulting world, you really get to see the people who had contingency plans and who didn't, right? Because they're the ones who are really thriving in this environment. And you think the last economic crisis that we had in 2008, the number of businesses that were launched out of that were the ones that really built that into how they went about doing their business. And that's really cool to see, you know, from someone who gets to come in their house and peek and, you know, walk around a little bit and then head out the door. Right. And so their attitudes, their behaviors and values are such to where that, you know, failure is an inevitable part of the process towards them getting better as a result of COVID and instead of the absence of it.
So that leads to my next question about how have you prepared yourself for your consulting role specifically, right? So you had an amazing Army career. You went on and got in with Texas A&M because you built relationships, and that led to, you know, knowing friends or having other coaches within the MLB from your time with the Mariners. So that all makes sense to me, right? So you kind of have done a great job of building a foundation, building that iceberg or that pyramid, if you will, and those two things are necessary. But the consulting, break that down for me. How did you prepare for it as you were leaving your, you know, day job, if you will, in the Army? And then how did you make sure you were successful as you went into it?
Yeah, it's, I mean, I think it just starts with a lot of humility. I mean, and I call it the white belt mindset, right? And a lot of the word mindset's thrown out a lot, but that's just a pattern of thinking, right? And so the deliberate pattern of thinking I have is being a white belt. So no matter, you think about it in martial arts, you know, the black belt is the teacher, they're the ultimate high level, and the white belt's the novice, right? So to me, my philosophy being a white belt is no matter, I have a whole bunch of black belt skills and experiences, but I have a white belt mindset, which means I approach it as someone who's willing to learn, willing to do whatever it takes to understand crap. Like, I'm not a business guy, right? But how do I learn about business, right? And so took advantage of opportunities. I went to Stanford for 4 weeks, and I kind of got a mini, you know, MBA out of the deal, you know? And so then, but you know, hey, that didn't make me a business guy. So now I have got, I understand the lexicon and I understand a little bit of the process. Now I immerse myself in like, for example, McChrystal Group, you know, I immerse myself in their process and how they do business. And then, you know, spend time with different aspects of the business, from sales to marketing, to the client facing side, to the teaching side. Just getting to know people, asking people questions. You know, you can't go wrong by being a curious person, right? And everybody loves to talk about themselves and what they do, right? You know, so you can't go wrong leading with those things. But if you do with a genuine curiosity and you're able to then take that information and then, you know, paint the picture as, you know, and it, so it wasn't like, you know, being a white belt doesn't mean I was a clean slate, right? You know, I was this person who's developed this knowledge, skills, and experience, right? And, you know, but to me, it was bringing what I observed, connecting it to what I already knew, understanding, and, you know, and then I have a new context and lens of how to apply what I know and what I don't know as a way of getting better. So then the client gets better, the team gets better. That, to me, that synthesis of that happening is really what is, I believe, is setting me up for success. I'll tell you, on February 1st, you know, when I, depending on how many offers I get, but to me, that's been the recipe for it. And I think the second one, it's oversimplified. Just, I call it good dudership, man. I mean, just being a good human being and trying to be kind and, you know, a person that someone is willing to trust and knows who they are and what they're about, isn't trying to prove myself. I think a lot of veterans get out and they're caught up in their identity with being a veteran and what that means. And I think one of the best pieces of advice that I had is that the general public's understanding of the military is probably at the fifth and sixth grade level. So I assume nothing, right? You know, and I think that, you know, in my mind, sometimes I'm like, man, do they know that I was a lieutenant colonel? Like, you know, I mean, nobody gives a shit, dude, you know? So you got to show me, you know, and everybody's from Missouri. You got to show me, right? So I think that's where the white belt mindset came in because you're starting over, dude. And I felt like, a lot of humility has helped me go on a long way, I think.
Nice. That's perfect, man. So I guess my next question to kind of flow along with that, right? So you kind of made yourself into three or four different hats or different professions, different jobs within, you know, your expertise. So How do you work on your mental state as you switch throughout those four different pieces, right? From Army, all of a sudden you're in the boardroom. From boardroom, all of a sudden you're working with the Rockies. From Rockies, you're going back to Texas.
Yeah.
How are you doing that? And obviously you're bringing Coors Light with you. And it's running on the Trans Am.
Great choice. Great
everything
choice.
Except for Sally Field was amazing about that movie. So,
oh man, I love it, man. That's awesome, man. I can't even answer that. It was so funny. I can't even answer that, man. It all begins and ends with Coors Light, man.
Coors Brewing Company, Coors Brewing Company. Happy to have you be a part of the show.
Awesome. Can I be honest with you guys? I mean, I don't always do it very well. And I'm going to be honest, and that's part of it, right? You know, that's being honest with myself, right? You know, I have good and bad days and days when I stress out and days when I'm not a very good dad or husband and, you know, days when it affects me on the job. I mean, I think having some self-compassion helps a little bit too. I'm a perfectionist. I like to be, you know, so I think, you know, exercising self-compassion, I think, as an older dude, the value of recovery is just super important, right? You know, and so really, you know, you and I talked a lot about this, Matt, you know, but like just, and again, when you're a young guy, you burn the candle from both ends, right? You just don't know what you don't know about recovery. And, you know, and you're in the military, it's like, you know, you have all these blinking lights that need to go service the engine, but, you know, you just, you completely ignore them and then until the engine's blown out, right? Physically and mentally, right? And so now that I'm aware of what my engine lights, I'm doing a lot of better job as far as my maintenance, right? And I build in time, like, you know, hey, so I make sure I get a lot of good rest. I'm still working on the nutrition. Matt's going to help me out with that. Fortunately, I still eat like a fullback. I practice my mindfulness and my meditation, you know, eat a couple minutes in the morning, 5 minutes during the day. I get my workout. Like if I don't work out, I'm just jacked up, you know? And so it doesn't, but working out is different for me now. Like, you know, I'd have to go crush myself until I'm like pass out on the floor, like Jocko to feel like I got a good workout. Right. You know, going to a workout sometimes meaning I just walked 5 miles with my dog, you know? I mean, to me, so if I broke a sweat, I'm freaking good, man. You know? And so, I think this, you know, staying connected with my family, we sit down and eat dinner. I think that's what's great about COVID is it's kind of brought us together more. And that could be that to me, it's an accelerator. It accelerates what was good about your relationships. It could accelerate what was bad about them or frayed or fractured. To me and my family, it's been stressful with the move. And so now that we're kind of back in this routine, which is a super important thing too, that I recommend is, we sit down and eat dinner together. You know, I shut it down at a certain time. Fridays are completely administrative days. I don't schedule stuff. You know, being very diligent with my calendar has been a challenge, you know, but like, you know, I needed an admin assistant, but I am afraid that if I do that, I lose control of that. And I need to maintain control of that in order to make sure that I'm in tune with, you know, where my time and energy is and when I need to shut it down.
So again, you're hitting so many things. My notes never end. the white belt mindset, right? So I'm gonna hit you with a quick story. I don't think me and you have ever talked about this. I think this might be the third time we referenced it on this podcast. So once upon a time, I'm this little slapdick intern at UConn, right? I'm trying to be a strength coach. And I don't necessarily look the part. I'm kind of athletic. I'm kind of not. I have glasses. I don't always have glasses. Like, I'm a weird dude. I'm just who I am. Yeah. Right. Lo and behold, it's like Clark Kent, and I take the glasses off. I'm a decathlete. I guess I'm athletic. And I had this mentor, right? I had this guy who was a GA, and when he left, he gave me this card, and the long and short of it was in the card, he wrote a note, and it said, "Treat every day like you're new." And it was one of the first times I had someone outside my personal family circle give me that kind of message, and it resonated really well, and I've saved the card. In the card was a gift card for food, so, you know, that was always nice, especially as a little schleppy intern. But that guy was actually Matt Powell. So it's a very interesting thing that you talk about a white belt mindset, and I have a guy here specifically, you know, shit, it's got to be 15 years now, who said exactly those words to me with just other words, but treat every day like you're new. And I think that fundamentally, as a very impressionable kid trying to be successful, having good mentors, was something I always took and something I always tried to pass on. So I loved you hit on it. And I think it applies not just in what we do, but in everything. It's one of those bleed out ideas. It bleeds into everything. And if you use it that way, it can do great things for you. That leads me to my question. You reference identity, right? And you talked about, you know, in your military career and people specifically in the military as they transition out their identity. Mm-hmm. I always said to myself, I was someone who did strength and conditioning. I never defined myself mm-hmm. as a strength and conditioning coach. And people mm-hmm. used to look at me like I was crazy. And I was like, no, I'm committed. I'm not committed. I just don't value myself as only being in that tiny box as who I am is strength coach.
Yeah, right.
So how do you define yourself?
Yeah.
And what tools, skills, whatever it is, you reference, you're the old guy in the room right now, you know, as the guy who's a little more seasoned, how do you define yourself for your personal identity? Mm-hmm. And then within that identity, mm-hmm. you reference scheduling, mm-hmm. time management, you have a family, you have this, you have that. So how did you go from defining yourself mm-hmm. to managing your time with who you are?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the long and short of it is that who I define myself, and I mentioned this earlier, is this, I'm a coach. I haven't always identified with being a coach. I think as I transitioned, I went through some really important processes that helped me out with that. I mean, first and foremost, through the Commit Foundation, shout out to them, and Court Whitman, I went through the process of, you know, again, like, you know, as a veteran getting out, I'm crossing this bridge, and most veterans get caught up in, hey, where am I going to go? What am I going to do? I need to get a job. But instead, it started off with, you know, who am I, you know, and what am I all about, right? I never had an executive coach before. And so it was something I was kind of like interested in, cause I was like, oh, I've kind of done that before, you know, meaning that I'd like done performance coaching with like executive level people. But I just going through that with him was just really informative to me, because that's when I fell on it, you know, cause he was very similar to me in terms of our journey and what we were about. And I read an article about, he had just retired, got in, who's a longtime friend and mentor of mine. His name's General Bob Brown, and he was the first captain to teach at the Center for Enhanced Performance at West Point. In his retirement speech, he was talking about himself being a coach. And the best positions he'd ever had in the military in 30-plus years was when they actually called him coach. And I was like, what? I never even heard of that before. And again, it makes sense, you know. And then he's really close friends. He played for Coach Krzyzewski, Coach K. Stuff like that too, to make sense of why he would identify that. But it really got me thinking about that, you know, what it means to be a coach, right? Because I kind of thought I was a teacher. I really enjoyed teaching. Like I enjoyed teaching at West Point, the Air Force Academy, and even had that tip. But I was like, no, because a teacher is kind of beholden to the classroom traditionally, right? I like being down in the arena with folks, and like I, and that's why my sign off is see you in the arena, right? And there's these different arenas we play in where performance really matters, right? And I think coaches really are the guys who are willing to get down with the people who are, you know, and they're getting, rolling up their sleeves, they're getting dirty, they're doing the work, and they may not be in the arena, they may not be within the middle of the arena, but they're sure as hell on the sidelines. They're not up at the sidelines, they're not outside the arena, they're down, they're putting themselves in it, and they're down there every single day. And then the things that I in the military where I really thrived and enjoyed it the most, where I was really in the arena, right? And, you know, and as a coach, and to me, that was the application of skills and seeing the return on the investment and seeing people struggle with things and then giving me immediate feedback. That's where I wanted to be, right? And so I think that's where this idea about being a coach in the sense of being a mental skills coach was one of them, but also someone who teaches leadership and really is all about helping making people better at what they do. And those skills and processes are the same regardless of what arena you're in. That's when really the lights came on and I was like, shit, let's giddy up, man. And you can see how excited I'm getting, right? You know, because that's like, you know, that's when, you know, two brain cells fire in succession and there's some smoke starts coming out of a guy's ears, right?
Goosebumps, maybe. Goosebumps.
Yeah.
So that brings me to my next question. And then after that, Andy, we're going to go into our last three questions we ask everybody who comes on the podcast. So my last question for you before we get into that is, what do you see as the future of your profession? What do you see as the future of cognitive performance or whatever term you want to use for it?
Yeah, you know, the easy answer would be technology, but that's not where I'm at, honestly. So, you know, add one more log to my fire is pursuing my PhD in educational psychology. And yeah, new news, bro. So hopefully start, inshallah, God willing, next semester. So to me, I mean, and you guys would totally agree with this, to me, that's that, you know, coaching mental skills through coaches is where it's at, right? So the idea about the SME being the center of gravity, if you will, using a military term, or being the person that you're going to go through and with in order to be able to teach mental skills, to me, that's out. Like, to me, empower, because the majority of coaches across America don't have that resource. You just talked about it, right? And so even at higher universities, they really don't have that, right? And so I think if we can create vehicles to then provide mental skills for coaches, they can get them in ways, and they deliver it in simple and practical ways that are in their language, delivered either online and mainly online, that are ways that add value to them, that they can then turn around and train their athletes. To me, that's where it's at. So it's really, you know, I don't want to call it, and it's, I think it's kind of democratizing mental skills is really where it's at. And then I also see, Matt is a great example of this, the rise of the interdisciplinary approach, right? Right now, within athletics and even in the military, we use a multidisciplinary approach, meaning it's about, hey, you know, we may be working in the same room or in the same unit, but we only get together once a month, sound familiar, Matt, and we talk about stuff and then we break, but then we go back to our silos, right? We're not really working together as a team, right? And so like, but like there's a paraprofessional, yeah, Matt's like laughing at, made me laugh. So, but like, here's the cool thing. Guys like Matt is a classic example, is a I call him a paraprofessional because he's got two like areas of expertise that makes him more likely that he's going to lean on those two areas of expertise. So that isn't that he's becoming the Swiss Army knife, but I think the Swiss Army knife isn't about individuals. It's about groups of people being in the Swiss Army knife, to use that metaphor. Right. So I think you're going to see
jack of all trades, master of none.
Yeah.
And that's, again, I reference it as being a decathlete. It's just, it makes sense to me.
Yeah. So
it's the connector person.
That's right. That's right.
You have enough knowledge and enough things to be dangerous, but you know not to be because you get someone who's better than you.
That's right. Well, imagine, and we're horrible on the performance side. We're a tribe, right? But on the pathology side, they're like another tribe, right? You know, and so, but they're still like Native Americans, right? You know, so we're really all part of one tribe, right? So it's like, you know, can you imagine instead of saying stay in your lane, we're saying get in my lane, and we're not getting pissed off when you get in my lane because you're reinforcing what I'm teaching, right? So to me, I see, you know, as the science and technology creates a vehicle for us to be better paraprofessionals, more interdisciplinary, and creating vehicles to get the skills in more practitioners' hands, especially coaches.
No, I love that. And I think that's so important long term. And obviously that's why I took the journey I did in order to get my RD and be a little more of a paraprofessional. I like that. I'm definitely stealing the hell out of that. I hope you're okay with it. I'll start trademarking it, maybe throw a Reese on the, I don't know. We'll figure it out.
You give me credit the first three times and it's yours.
So I love that though. I love that idea of being that kind of connector. And it's always kind of been my personality too, right? I've always wanted to go learn more about more. Every time I have somebody like you around, I'm going to freaking learn as much as I can so I can steal as much as I can and then move on to the next person. I'm like a terrible parasite in many ways in life. And this is just another way, you know, like it just.
Yeah. But you know, Matt, like I do, I mean, but not everybody thinks like us. Right. You know? And so the idea is that, hey, when people are not, you know, don't necessarily have that natural tendency to be that way, can we still be interdisciplinary? Right. And I think that to me is the real challenge. You know, especially people who are in charge of programs to kind of start to figure that out, right?
No, I agree. And that high performance model only works if that person at the top knows how to utilize the people underneath them. I know so many people who are PhDs and go to these amazing professions, amazing spots in the profession, and they do a terrible job because one, they don't know how to interconnect with people and actually create a team. And two, they don't know how to actually build things from the ground up because they don't know enough about each thing they're supposed to build out of, right? They might know a little about metal or a little bit about wood, but they don't know how to put the two together to build a freaking whole shower and bathroom and then do the green board and then do the tile. They're going to screw that all up as opposed to actually, you know, working them together. So you just end up with a pile of materials that could have been great, but they just sit there in their own separate pile.
Oh, okay.
All right. So that brings us to our last three questions we ask everybody. Andy, my first question for you is, and you've touched on it briefly about, you know, when you're kind of burning the candle at both ends, but how do you manage your own personal time and keep balance? So how are you keeping people in and out of the door, right? So the most important part is, who do you open the door for? How do you balance that time?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's not about time, right? Because time is a finite resource, right? It's about managing my energy, right? You know, so energy is my capacity to do work, right? You know, so there's a physiological component, mental and emotional piece too, right? And so if I'm doing a really good job about managing my energy, the time kind of takes care of itself. And so that's super important. And I mentioned kind of some of the strategies that go about doing that, you know, in terms of how I apply my energy within the construct of time, you know, it's going back to like who I let in and who I don't, you know. First of all, if it's not a hell yes, then it's a no. I mean, that seems simple, but there's some criteria that kind of goes into that. It's like, hey, who is this person? And I found this is kind of interesting. I heard this from somebody who's at A&M that I work with, because I was trying to understand the operating environment, right? It's what, you know, if you're doing it right, it's kind of what you do. Especially, I love these unwritten rules of the road. And he told me something that stuck with me that I want to share with you guys. I think you agree, it works in any complex operating environment, right? Is that, hey, it's not about who you know, it's not about what you know, it's about who knows you, right? So to me, that was like, oh, well, I mean, you know, and I'm a digital connector, and I'm a connector by nature, right? You know, but I've had to learn about, like, to be very precise about how I connect people. So I'm very precise about who connects with me, right? Especially now that I'm in these fields where there's a lot of people who want to hit you up for nefarious reasons or market all kinds of bullshit. There's a lot of white noise. So how do I cut through that? Right. So it's all about, like, you know, who knows me and, you know, and who knows them. Right. So that's pretty important. They kind of get filtered out that way. LinkedIn helps out with stuff like that a little bit. And then it's like, you know, but I always give if I'm going to connect with somebody to explore something and I don't know them, it's because there's a compelling reason to do so, right? You know, and they align with one or more of my values or my purpose, right? And it's not transactional ever as it starts. It's always personal, right? And if the person goes right to transactional, then they're out. Like, you know, I ain't got time for that, right? Because to me, you know, and I've learned this by even misstepping sometimes, you know, and to, you know, to where you're selling something or you're selling yourself, instead of like doing like I the Iraqis and the Afghanis I learned with, you know, whenever you got in a shura or we call it key leader engagement, it, you can never be transactional. You just slow down and tell me about how you're doing, how your wife and kids, all this stuff too. Like those interpersonal moments are what build trust and rapport. It's not about the transaction, right? But, and so I just, you know, and the other criteria I weed people out with is like the 15-minute phone call. I'm like, what the fuck are we going to get done in 15 minutes? I mean, we're going to do an introductory phone call and you want to do 15 minutes? Hell no. You're out, dude. You know, so, I mean, it's like simple things like that. But you know, so a lot of these are through trial and error, right? I mean, I had a construct, but through trial and error, then I've kind of come up with this criteria.
Nice. So second one, right? Totally in the other direction. We're going somewhere 180 degrees. For $500 or less, what is the most impactful thing you have purchased that has helped you?
Well, that's a good, that's a good Tim Ferriss question. For $500 or less, what is the one thing that has impacted me?
And any domain and anything you've done, we've had people answer personally. We've had people answer business. It's been things. It's been, you know, buying something. It's been using it to do something, whatever comes to mind.
Hmm. That's a lot of different questions. My mind goes all kinds of different ways with that. I mean, I guess the easy layup answer is can I say two things? Can I say one? Am I strict to a one?
You can say whatever you want.
So the one thing is it was free. Is this book, Design Your Life. It's pretty freaking awesome. This version right here. I've given this away so many times. So I got it for free, but I bought so many of them. I spent less than $500, but this was huge because it goes back to identity and who you are and what you're about. And I've learned about design methodology and how that applies to you as an individual. I think that's huge. And then this is a fun one that you guys appreciate. That's because it helps me recovery so damn much. So we did this Tactical Athlete Performance Center pilot program. You know, it's kind of like Ranger Athlete Warrior, right? But for big army. And we had those Theraguns, right? You know, Theraguns, but when Theraguns, you know what I'm talking about? And they're like $500. I'm like, I'm a cheap bastard, so I'm like, I'm not going to pay for that. Well, one of our captains, he's actually in Ranger Regiment right now, was like, I got a great hack for this. He's like, you got a jigsaw? You just go buy these Rehab Armory things in them. And it's funny, I'm so proud of this stupid thing, man. And it's like, you know, so I bought a $75 refurbished jigsaw on Amazon. I spent $30 Rehab Armory to get the different bits. And I just freaking pound the shit out of myself with this like homemade therapy gun. And oh. It's freaking amazing, man. Like, but I'm banned from like the living room doing it anymore because nobody hears the television. So that's the downside. The shadow side of using the homemade Theragun is that it's really fucking loud, but it's actually way more powerful than a Theragun. And if you're a big dude like me, you need all the help you can get.
So let me throw a quick caveat in here. I love that. So, and we didn't get to it. So it's probably a conversation for another day. The people you touch throughout your career, you never know. And again, the way we operate, good people, keeping the circle close, but also being willing to expand when necessary. I have a former athlete who she wasn't my athlete, but it was someone who I worked with and I have a lot of respect for both as a person and as the professional she's become. Caroline Jarmock, shout out to Jarmock. She's the director of international sales for Hyper Ice is the company who makes the Hypervolt, among other things. She's making huge moves. So if you need me to connect you with the actual best company who makes these devices, I know sometimes.
Well, shit, giddy up, man.
Yeah, but I'll make the LinkedIn connection. And I'll give you, Jarmock is someone who, engineer by trade, I believe she was an All-American-ish level. I don't know if she was actually an All-American in volleyball at KU. Yeah. But she's an academically trained engineer who's now the international director of sales for, I think they just raised like $50 million or something in their Series B or Series C.
Right. So, yeah.
easy connection to make.
I love it, man. Yeah, I love no tech, low tech, and high tech solutions, man. Like, you know, like, hey, this is freaking no tech, right? And then we got high, you know, medium tech, you know, I guess with the jigsaw, the jigsaw there gun, and then high tech. There you go, man.
Maybe that brings us to our last question here, man. So who, one of the things obviously we know is important is who coaches you, right? So we know who we coach. You talked about all the things. Who coaches you and why that person or that group of people, that brain trust?
Yeah. I mean, I really have kind of this executive board of mentors that provide different perspectives to me, if you will. So like I have a group of coaches, I think you will. And I think like that's this executive board concept was something that was introduced to me by a family member of mine. And then so just, and then people who've been in my life for various reasons who knew me at certain parts and know me since then and stay plugged in. Do you want me to name their names or just okay. Yeah. I mean, they're just people that I really look up to, and you know, the people you come across that, you know, speak to you in certain ways and watch you kind of grow up and watch you struggled and fail and everything in between, and just speak the truth to you, right? They don't tell you what you, that's what's super important. And I try to, and that's what's so cool about being in this phase of my career in life is that I get to have all these people pour into me. And then, you know, I made this weird shift where now I'm get to do the same thing to other people, but then mine continues. And I think that's kind of what becoming a black belt is really all about, right? You know, they're not the quintessential badass. They're a teacher. They multiply their efforts. They create, you know, they create more, their job is to create more black belts. Right. And so I think that's really where the servant part of me has come into. And so, people like just pick up the phone and just ask a dumb question. And then we joke around about something and, you know, we catch up, and then I can ask a really hard question, and then I know they're going to shoot me straight. Right. You know, and, no bullshit. Right. And there's no agenda. There's nothing, ever, you know, twisted about it. And then, and they're also accessible, right? You know, cause like sometimes you have mentors in your life, they're just are really taxed with their time. Right. And people ebb and flow with that too. But like, I mean, you know, if somebody's really important to you in your life, they're going to make time for you, you know? And I think that's really important.
I think you hit it earlier too, when you talked about self-awareness. You only have self-awareness when you have other people to help you find self-awareness. You cannot be self-aware by yourself.
No, you can't.
But you really can't. So,
no, you're right. You're 100% correct. We all have blind spots. Yeah.
Absolutely. Anything you want to plug or talk about? How could people reach you? Anything like that?
Before we sign off? Yeah. No. I think you know, the one thing I do want to plug, and this is just for coaches everywhere, because I'm a coach for coaches by coaches, that check out the Texas A&M Coaching Academy. You can Google that. Check it out. We got a new website coming out, new podcast coming out, ironically. And I think it's just going to be a great resource that's going to be able to help out a lot of people out there. And so how to get a hold of me, I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. You can find me there. And then you can find me on Instagram, probably the next level social media. I have Twitter account, but I'm kind of not as – I don't have as much of a following on Twitter, much at all too. You can also, my company is Designed to Perform. So be on the lookout for that as kind of, we build that out and get a more of a website and resources and a presence on social media. And then, and just reach out to me and, you know, and, just make sure that you're not trying to sell anything, you know, but like, I love to, you know, don't leave with the sales pitch. Like, you know, going back to earlier.
You don't just want the message being like, I have this service or product. Do you want to buy it? That's not a good lead-in.
Oh no, yeah, exactly, right. Get out of here.
Hey, you absolutely crushed it today. Exactly like I knew you would. And the other thing I want you to plug real quick, I want you to plug your book, man. Like, you handed me a signed copy of that book, and you absolutely crushed your chapter in there. That really was a really good book, and I'll let you plug it real quick before we sign off.
Yeah, thanks, man. Deliberate Discomfort was an awesome project through Mission 60, a company I consult with. And essentially, it's a story about 12 special operations veterans, a couple of Medal of Honor winners, just like call them real life action figures, and talking about their journeys, and but from combat and back and everything in between. And then we connect their stories that you may not be able to relate to by you know, talking about the behavioral science and how it applies to you, how you can take what they experience and apply it to your life, you know, personally and professionally. And then my role in it was to kind of weave this thread, especially through the science section on all 12 of the chapters as an editor. It was awesome to help kind of put that together. And then, you know, and I helped write chapter 1 and chapter 11. And then just, this was a really fun project. It's not quite a New York Times bestseller, very close, but we were a number one Amazon bestseller. So excited about that. I think we've had over 20,000 books sold, just amazing feedback. And just something I was excited to be a part of that process. And to say I'm a published author is kind of fucking crazy. So, but you know, I dig it, right, Joe?
Hey, man, like I said, I did mine for a personal catharsis, didn't market it, didn't do anything, just did it to do it. But I look back on it, and I'm like, wow, I did that. It's like a little notch on the belt, a little pat on the back. It feels good. So, hey, man, you're in the club. We got to get Matt one day to join that club.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think you'd agree that I think the biggest thing that's a joy about that to me is like hearing about how it's like, it's a manual, right? You know, it's more, instead of like a novel, just a series of stories, it's more of a how-to. And to hear from people about how our book has helped them in some way, that's made all the difference in the world. And it wasn't about the money or anything like that too. Just about, so it's about to be able to say that you helped somebody because of what some, you know, words in a book is, to me, is amazing.
Nah, you absolutely crushed this interview, man. You crushed this podcast. And I loved everything about that book and the way you guys interwove everything. And obviously, Rusty Witt being a strength coach now at multiple locations and knowing him third party, Joe, you might know him, just another great way to tie it all together, man. We appreciate you coming on tonight, man. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Appreciate it. See you in the arena.
Later, buddy. Yeah.
Thank you, Andy. Have a good night.
Good night, guys.